Several years ago, I went on one of the many trips I take to the hospital. This was Kennestone Hospital this particular time. Chuck Lackey was having back surgery. It was pretty serious, or we thought so. Turns out all he needed was a little piece of coral inserted in his back, and that was the end of that. So while we waited for them to put this in, I sat in the waiting room with Pam, and Chuck's parents had come up because it was pretty serious, and there was another pastor there and another man with him that I didn't really know. Now, if you did not meet Chuck's mother before Alzheimer's changed the way she interacts, you missed a pleasure. And this was one of those rare moments. As the conversation lagged at one point, Chuck's mom looked at this gentleman that I didn't know that was there with the other pastor, and she says, "What do you do for a living?" And he said, "I'm his assistant pastor." And she was flabbergasted, and she said, "You're a what?" And he said, already a little on the defensive, "I'm his assistant. I help him." And she said, "He's a pastor. You help him? He doesn't do anything. What do you help him do? Not work?" Now, I can't remember the rest of what she said, but this went on at least four interactions where she said things like, "What do you help him do? Not work?" And I'm sitting there just kind of going. And this poor guy was rendered speechless. He didn't think to say, "Well, a lot of the times I come here and answer silly questions," or, "Here's what a pastor does and I help him do that." Before she was through with him, he was stuttering. Never did manage to answer her question. She finally just left him trembling there. It sure was fun to watch, I just have to say. You got to be a little laid back about this, and it doesn't offend me, so I'm just going, so funny. Now, not many people are as forthright as Mrs. Lackey, but I would wager that most of you have wondered what in the world a pastor does all day. You know, did you wake up craving fried chicken and not wanting to go to work and took that to be a call to the ministry? You know, what do you do all day? Well, this morning I want you to think about that with me. What spiritual leadership in the pastor is supposed to look like. If you were given the task of evaluating the effectiveness of a pastor, what kind of questions would you ask? What would you look for? How would you know if someone was effective? Would you know what he's supposed to be doing so you could evaluate him at all? It's a knotty issue. Not many people know much about this. It's weird. It's not like your job. So to help you a little, I did some research this week. I looked at some ads from people who are actually looking for a pastor right now so that I could get an idea of what they think I'm supposed to be doing. One of them said, "Please embrace this opportunity to show us how your experience can touch the hearts of our congregation." Okay. Another church is looking for someone with skill in change management. And I thought, none of the churches... Is there a church that wants to change? They want skill in change management and team building. This was my favorite, though. The ideal candidate will have a history of effective multiplication and I'm going, I didn't save any of my math tests. And able to recruit by vision casting. And then there was one that I didn't understand, but you may be able to help me with it. Something about creating relevant environments. Now, after this brief sachet through the internet, I concluded that there are a lot of people besides Von Seel Lackey who don't know what a pastor does all day. This morning we're looking at the closing comments of the book of Colossians. We've been studying this book verse by verse. This is the last day of the study. Don't cheer. It's been a rich book. And the final statements of this book give us an insight into what a pastor is supposed to be and do. This part of Colossians 4 is not written from the same perspective as other texts about a pastor. 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1 give us a list of things, and if the man fails on any point, then he's not qualified to be a pastor. It's very cut and dried. Here's what you look for. Passages like 1 Peter 5, most of the rest of 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, most of the rest of Titus give objective commands directly to the pastor, so that you can look at the command that the pastor is supposed to read and say, okay, ours is doing that or not, and you get an idea from that, a sort of a different look at it. This is another kind of look in which some personal comments are being made by Paul, who is functioning as a pastor, and some of those comments about Epaphras, who is the pastor or a pastor in the church at Colossae. Now, these were people who lived a long time ago. I'm about to create a relevant environment, I think. They lived a long time ago. And the immediate circumstances of this stuff we're about to read have passed from the scene many centuries ago. But God preserved these insights into their lives and kept them intact in His Scripture for us, not for them. Whatever it was going to do for them, it did a long time ago. And now it's our turn. These verses show us some glimpses of their character and of how they function in their roles. This passage kind of helps us flesh out the list in 1 Timothy 3 and the list in Titus 1 and some of the commands in the rest of the books. Help us know what a pastor should be. Let's look together at Colossians chapter 4, verses 12 through 18. Colossians 4, 12 through 18. It says, Epaphras, who is one of your number, a bondslave of Jesus Christ, sends you his greetings, always laboring earnestly for you in his prayers, that you may stand perfect and fully assured in all the will of God. For I testify for him that he has a deep concern for you and for those who are in Laodicea and Hierapolis. Luke, the beloved physician, sends you his greetings, and also Demas. Greet the brethren who are in Laodicea, and also Nympha and the church that is in her house. When this letter is read among you, have it read in the church of the Laodiceans, and you, for your part, read my letter that is coming from Laodicea. Say to Archippus, take heed to the ministry which you have received in the Lord, that you may fulfill it. I, Paul, write this greeting with my own hand. Remember my imprisonment. Grace be with you. Now, these verses give us some insights into these two men's lives, and from these I want to draw some conclusions for you about what an effective pastor must look like. And the first characteristic of an effective pastor that we see here is dedication to private prayer. In the first part of this passage, Paul is conveying greetings to the Colossians sent by their pastor, Epaphras. He commends Epaphras as a bondslave of Jesus Christ, and then he tells them how often and how fervently this man is spending his time praying for them. He says of Epaphras, always laboring earnestly for you in his prayers, that you may stand perfect and fully assured in the will of God. Now, this is a strong commendation of this man's diligence. And it's an insight for us into what a pastor is supposed to be doing all day, or at least a good part of the day. Now, I want you to think about the situation this man was in. He was on a trip to Rome. He had gone there to talk to Paul. It's 1,000 miles, roughly, from Colossae to Rome. He was there in a time when travel was considerably more difficult than it is now. It took a lot longer, obviously. He'd already been gone a long time, and he's going to be gone a long time more before he gets back home. And so he can't preach to them from Rome. There's no way to email an MP3. You can't overnight a CD. There's no practical way for the church at Colossae to benefit from Epaphras' daily study of the Scripture until he is able to return to them and take up normal duties in the congregation. He can't counsel them. He's not able to visit them to encourage them. He's not able to spend time with them for any other purpose. He can't answer their questions. He can't call them on the phone because that doesn't exist yet. This greeting may be the only time they heard from him during his absence. Or maybe there were others, but there wouldn't have been many because of the difficulty of getting a letter taken to a specific place. He cannot see to any of the administrative duties that he had, whatever those would have been in that time and place. He certainly can't do effective multiplication or cast vision or create relevant environments if he's in Rome and there in Colossae. And so what he can do is pray for them fervently, diligently. He can contend for them in prayer, and that's what he's doing. For those of us who give something to the church in a way that it can be traced, the IRS makes us send you a letter about that if you're to be able to write it off your taxes, and they mandate what the letter says. It has to have the amount, the check number if it's over a certain amount, and it has to have this statement at the bottom, or when they audit you, they won't count it. And the statement says, no goods or services were provided you by the church in connection with any contribution, or their value was insignificant, or consisted entirely of intangible religious benefits. Now, the thing that's happened in the last few years is churches will have trips, and people will pay through the church to go on the trips, and then somebody occasionally would claim that check as a write-off, and so now you have to have a confirmation from the church of which part of your checkbook actually went to giving. But that last part is what I want to call your attention to. That whatever you got out of this gift consisted entirely of intangible religious benefits. You little guys know what intangible means? It means you can't see it, you can't taste it, you can't touch it. It's hard to define. It's something that's kind of, like when we ask you who broke that lamp, your response to that is intangible. Can't define it easily. Well, what Epaphras is doing for this church while he's in Rome is as intangible as a religious benefit can get. He's praying for them. They don't even know he's praying for them until this letter comes several weeks later. And then they've got Paul's word for it. Now, if my giving gets me a chair to sit in and air conditioning in August and heat in January, you know, that's tangible. I can see that. I can recognize the benefit. If my giving purchases a sound system and a keyboard so that the music is nice and I can hear, then I can see that. But prayer? Now, it's not that any of us would say this isn't a benefit. We know that we need to be praying for each other, but it's hard to notice the benefit. We don't know when he's praying. We don't know how much he's praying or whether he thought of me today at all. And then when God blesses us, if we don't just say, well, I sure was lucky, if we say I was blessed, we don't know how much of that blessing goes with that praying. You can't quantify it. It's hard to perceive. It's hard to define. It's easily overlooked. And so I want to call your attention to what Paul expects this fervent praying to accomplish in a church 1,000 miles away and why Epaphras is laboring in prayer. It's at the end of verse 12. That you may stand perfect and fully assured in all the will of God. That's the benefit. That's why Epaphras is laboring in prayer day after day after day. This is a key way in which God has provided for his church to flourish and thrive. This is why Epaphras can be 1,000 miles away before email and be effective in his contribution to the ongoing ministry of that church. This is why Paul thought his ministry was commendable. He labored in prayer. When there's nothing else in the job description of a pastor that he could do effectively, he could still be effective if he would just do this, and he did it. And Paul said, man, he's doing a good job. Effectual prayer is a necessary part of bringing Christians to perfection and enabling all of us to walk in a confidence of the will of God day by day. In Acts chapter 6, when they had the problem in the church of the Hellenistic widows being left out of the daily distribution of food to the widows, the ones that spoke Hebrew were doing fine, but the ones that didn't were being neglected. It was a major crisis in the church. If somebody didn't step up and meet this ministry need, the church could not go forward. Everyone recognized that that was the case once the problem became public. Everybody saw it. And the apostles, the leaders of the church, refused to step up and do that ministry. When the church had grown to the point where they couldn't do it all, the only things they refused to part with were prayer and the ministry of the word. And they refused to be distracted from those two by a ministry the church had to have to keep functioning. They said, we're not going to be distracted from this in order to do this ministry of waiting tables. And so you find some people in the congregation that you trust, and we're going to give it to them. We have to be about prayer and the ministry of the word. We cannot be distracted from these things. And Epaphras could still do the first of those things. When we humble ourselves and recognize that only God can do what we want to see done, that only God can give the blessings that we want to receive, only God can bless a church, only God can bless a family, only God can give you personally the things that you long for, then we will be faithful to ask Him. And the pastor and the pastors of the church, the elders, have to lead in this ministry that really applies to the whole congregation. An effective pastor is going to be off somewhere by himself where you don't know what he's doing, just like Jesus was so much of the time. They have to come hunting for him. Oh, he's praying again. What's up with that? Jesus, don't you know there's a revival going on? Man, people are asking about you. It's so hard to get how vital this is. And the pastor has to lead in this. Effective leaders are dedicated to personal prayer. Effective leaders are dedicated to personal intimacy with other people. That's number two, if you're a note taker, personal intimacy with others. In the abundance of error that has come into the church in our lifetimes, there are many false views of the pastor. One that's fairly recent. I remember it being the late 80s, I think, the first time I heard these two expressions. One popular leader proclaims that to grow beyond a certain point, for a church to grow beyond a certain point, the pastor has to stop being a shepherd and start being a rancher. I remember the chair I was sitting in the first time somebody told me that and was serious. And I said, I don't remember anything about ranching in Scripture. And so dedicated was this man to his philosophy that he had an immediate answer. He wouldn't consider that that's not a biblical concept. Others use the title of CEO, Chief Executive Officer of the Church. And the idea behind both of these philosophies is that to be effective and grow beyond a certain size, because that's the idol of so many churches, the pastor has to become aloof from the people and refuse to be bogged down in personal issues with other people, and has got to be vision casting and all of that other important stuff and not get distracted with your problems. Just delegate that. These men actually tell pastors to be aloof, to be detached, to act as visionaries, as if you can't be that with people around you. And sadly, over these years now since these two views or these two ideas of the same view have become popular, a lot of pastors in smaller churches have embraced these ideas in hopes that somehow indifference to people will propel them to greatness. Now, their church is smaller than the one out there in California where some of this is coming from, and so they think that if they just start ignoring their people, then that's going to fix it all. And then they wonder, you know, why isn't this working? Well, I'm sure you know there's something wrong with those views. But you might not have noticed what an incredibly strong emphasis the Scripture puts on the opposite view, which is that a pastor is to be intimately involved in people's lives. Personally involved. A pastor is to have relationships with other people. Broad involvement with other people. A pastor has to love people. Don't make anyone an elder who is inattentive to people. A pastor has to have some insights into people. And Paul noticed these characteristics in Epaphras, and he commends them to the church so that the church at Colossae would know a good thing when they had it. Verse 13, he says, "For I testify for him that he has a deep concern for you and for those who are in Laodicea and Hierapolis." Now, we've just seen how Epaphras is praying for them diligently and faithfully to the point that Paul goes, "Well, he's doing some good praying." To do that, you have to know people. You know, if you're going to go more than about 3 minutes with something to say, you have to know them, don't you? And now we learn that he's so deeply concerned for them that Paul can notice it and be confident in commending it to them that it'll resonate true. They'll know, they're being reminded that he loves them. They won't doubt it, but they do need to be reminded. He loves his people. He loves these two sister churches. Laodicea was right across the valley. You could see the buildings on a clear day. Hierapolis was further away, but not all that far. These three communities kind of hung together. They were off the beaten path a little bit, but a nice, strong community, a lot of interaction, and the churches interacted. The Christians there knew the other Christians in the next towns. They weren't ingrown, and Epaphras was leading in that. He didn't limit himself to the home folks. He was stretching out beyond his known circle of people, always trying to see where God might be opening a door with more people. Now, some of these crazy ideas about what a pastor is supposed to do come from the hard reality that you can't do everything. Most people and every pastor have learned that there's a limit to the number of people you can be intimately involved with. We're finite. We can't do it all. We can't know everybody. We can't be as close to everybody. Jesus wasn't even as close to everybody in the 12. He had his three, and then he had the rest. But no matter how strong you are, no matter how tough you are, no matter how outgoing you happen to be by temperament, there's a limit. And the biblical answer to your personal limitations or the personal limitation of the pastor is to add elders as the church grows and expect every one of the pastors to be intimate with some people, to know them and love them. This doesn't mean by having this be commended in Epaphras that only the pastor is to be this way. What it means is that the pastor must lead in this thing that's expected of all Christians. And in these next verses, Paul makes clear that he expects it of everybody else too. Verse 15, "Greet the brethren who are in Laodicea and also Nympha and the church that is in her house. When this letter is read among you, have it also read in the church of the Laodiceans. And you, for your part, read my letter that is coming from Laodicea." There's enough contact between these places that they're sharing resources that Paul can say, make Laodicea read this. And they're going to go to them and say, "You need to read this." And where's the one from Paul to you? He said, "I ought to read that. Come on, give it over." Nobody's to be aloof. And nobody who is aloof is ever to be allowed to be an elder. This is just how Christians are supposed to be. The pastors need to lead. Now, we're all bent in different ways. And I'm not suggesting that you quiet people need to stop being quiet people. So don't freak out. And we're not saying that you've got the wrong personality and it's sin, and if you don't start being a little more vivacious, we're going to do church discipline or something. It's not like that. We're all different, and that's a good thing. But no one is to be self-centered and aloof. People who are quiet still interact with other people. They just have their own way about it. People who are real bubbly have their way about it. But everybody's to interact. And you have something valuable to give that your church needs. You have no right to isolate yourself from your church. Then it becomes sin. You have no right to just focus on yourself and wait around for somebody to bless you all the time. Nobody did this for me. Nobody did that for me. Well, get busy and do something, and you'll be amazed how God will pour blessings into your lap. Don't be aloof. It's not the Christian way. It's not what God would have for any of us. And anyone who refuses to love other people, don't make them an elder. Don't make them a pastor. Well, Paul sees in Epaphras the right kind of love for people that Epaphras is serving. He has a deep concern. He longs for them to be blessed. He's leading that church in the people stuff. A good pastor is going to be committed to private prayer, to personal intimacy with other people, and to public exhortation. This is the third one, public exhortation. Now, at this point, our example switches to Paul, who wrote the letter. But the point is that pastors have to be willing to say what people need to hear. And people don't always want to hear that. I know, because I'm a people. You don't always want to hear what you need to hear, right? And sometimes in a church, maybe even often, the one who needs to hear it is fine with it, but somebody else is going to get mad when you say it, because they're thinking about the consequences in their own life. And so sometimes what needs to be said can be really, really hard to say. And if you've ever been burned a couple of times, it gets harder to say. And yet a pastor has to be willing to do that and has to have some skill at doing it so that you're not pouring gasoline on a fire when you do speak up. Now, throughout this letter, Paul demonstrates that kind of leadership for us. He corrects, he rebukes, he encourages with tremendous skill a church that's having some serious problems, and he addresses them. It's quite a study just to look at the way he interacts on those hard issues. And in this portion of the letter, he's still doing that. He commends certain things in people. In the verses that we just read, he's pointing out some things. He's emphasizing some things. And he's leaving a lot of other things unsaid, isn't he? Nothing in there about multiplication. I don't know why he left that out, but he was thinking about it. You know, he's picking what he says. He's choosing carefully what to emphasize and what to leave out. And in verse 17, he gives a very specific public exhortation. It says, "Say to Archippus, take heed to the ministry which you have received in the Lord, that you may fulfill it." Now, for us who are living past the circumstance, it's hard to know quite what Paul is doing here. It could be that Archippus has been warned privately about laziness or a lack of taking heed, some problem, some lack of diligence in his ministry, and that now Paul is giving him a very carefully worded reminder, but at the same time putting the church on notice that they need to be careful. I don't necessarily think it's that. It's one of the possibilities. Maybe a little more likely is that Archippus is a young man in the ministry, maybe taking on some extra duties while Epaphras is gone, and that this is the kind of exhortation that Timothy and Titus receive in their letters. Now, there was a lot of this kind of stuff written to them, and so maybe this is a reminder to a young man in the ministry that you're going to have to be very diligent, and this is just an exhortation. But for some reason, Paul decided that it needed to be public rather than passed on privately. It's possible that he was away somewhere doing some ministry and somebody's going to see him first and that person needs to tell him. But this letter was to be read publicly in that church and then sent to Laodicea so that it could be read during the worship service in that town. So this is very public. And they would have known what kind of man he was and what kind of exhortation this was. What you and I can know from the fact that this is here is that Paul is being attentive to their needs. He's being very thoughtful in what he says and what he doesn't say, and that there was some reason why this needed to be public, either because of the seriousness of the role or because there might have been some problem in the man, or because he's going to be hard to find with where he's gone to serve temporarily, and whoever finds him first, be sure and give him this encouragement. Whatever the reason, maybe one I haven't thought of. Paul had a purpose. He's very careful, but he's saying what he needs to say. He's not concerned about feelings as much as about what needs to be accomplished, although he's wording it enough that he's thinking about feelings. Now, there are just always things that need to be said carefully and thoughtfully, and the pastor has to say them. The ability to say them is one of the... Without putting gasoline on the fire is one of the things you can look for before you put somebody in that job. Well, there are a lot of other things that a pastor does that we could say. These are just from this text. The emphasis here is on a pastor's ministry to other people through prayer, through personal involvement in their lives, through saying what people need to hear, maybe even sometimes when they don't want to hear it. This is not pastors just being a nice guy, you know, going to out-nice the other guys, so let's put him in that job. The thing I want you to get today is that the Bible teaches in Ephesians 4 that God gave pastors to the church for the equipping of the saints. That this role in the church is a gift from God for the church, for the good of the church, and that if you're a Christian, then the pastors are in the church for your blessing, to strengthen you, to equip you, to encourage you. And this is from God and not from the guy. For any man to be effective, God has to give him the right spiritual gifts for the job, has to empower him daily in the work, and has to grant blessings in the results. It's not about the man. This is from God. All of those things God has to do every day, but he does them. And he does them for the benefit of his church, for your spiritual good, so that you can be blessed. And so we all need to know from the scripture what a pastor is supposed to be like, what he's supposed to do, because God has designed this so that we can be strengthened and so that the church can thrive. God raises men up. He gives them spiritual gifts. He enables them to function. He blesses the results. Now, as our church grows, we will have to add more men to this role. And the church will continue to thrive as God raises those men up and enables them. And your personal relationships that are very close, if you're willing to have them with a leader in the church, may not be with me. May not be with me even now. Might be Tim more than me. And that's how it's supposed to work. Even with the number we have, you'd kill me. And so we interact with more than one pastor. This is the biblical model, plural elders in one church. So this is here from God. It's here for your benefit. It does not always work as beautifully as it might. If there's any awkwardness or any inattentiveness on my part, if there's anything unseemly, if there's anything that hurts unnecessarily, blame that on me. I am one of the number of frail pastors. Blame that on Tim. He's not perfect either. But when you're fed, when you're blessed, when you're ministered to, I want you to recognize not me and not Tim and not whoever's next on that list. I want you to recognize that this is by God's design and that God is personally empowering this ministry in your life so that you can be blessed and give Him glory. So that you can come to perfection, so that you can walk in all the will of God, knowing confidently that you're in His will. God gave some as pastors for His glory. For your sake. Pray with me.